Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 307, Companion Cube, to episode 306. I'm not going to go through the whole intro again, but if you skipped over 306 and you're listening to this and you want to know what the hell's going on, just listen to the intro on 306. It explains everything, why there are two podcasts, just in a brief nutshell. Episode 306 is with Gabe Newell, and it's all about gaming and Valve, Valve's perspective on games, with Gabe and then Robin Walker and David Sawyer and Will Wheaton and Chloe Dykstra. Myself, and then 307 is just Chloe and myself talking to Gabe from a month earlier, all about Valve as a company. So two separate podcasts, didn't want to lose any material, and Gabe was kind enough to give us a ton of time, so I'm just putting all the information out there. So here you go. This episode also brought to you by Falcon Northwest Computers. That's falcon-nw.com. They will help you customize the perfect gaming rig, any kind of gaming computing system that you want. You want a tower system or a frag box or a superpower gaming laptop, they will do it any color you want, any configuration you want. They'll put customized graphics on it, and they have amazing customer service, and they're super nice. So if you are ready to upgrade or make the leap to a really what we would call a big boy computer, then you're going to want to go to falcon-nw.com. Falcon Northwest Computers, super great guys, great company, great machines. And now I'll make up a jingle that they did not approve. Falcon Northwest Computers, better than an actual falcon. Scraw! If you did not listen to episode 306, then you have missed the fact that we are having a huge Valve Nerdist contest. If you go to Nerdist.com, you can get all the details. But basically, Valve wants to send you to the DICE Summit in Las Vegas. It runs between February 5th and 8th. They're inducting Gaben into the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. So Valve is going to give you two first-class tickets, airfare tickets to the summit. You're going to get passes to the summit. You're going to get a room at the Hard Rock Hotel and seats front and center for Gabe's keynote. So if you're a Valve fan or a Nerdist fan, then this contest should make your brain shit itself. We basically just want you to design some sort of Valve Nerdist mashup artwork, not for any reason, just for fun. Just want to see what you would do with it. How would you mash up our two companies in artwork using their icon, anything from their world and anything from our world, and you're going to send that in JPEG and PNG or GIF file formats to contest@nerdist.com by 6 p.m. January 25th, and we will announce the results pretty quickly after that. So again, go to nerdist.com for all the info on that. And now, this podcast, it's Gabe Newell again, the very first time that we talked to him a month before, just talking about Valve as a company. So it's basically one of the smartest people in the world talking about one of the best companies in the world. Why would you need anything else for the next hour and 15 minutes? And like I said in the intro on 306, I took Chloe up there with me for this one. She is way more intense of a gamer than I am, and most people that I know. I remember one year at GDC, she wanted to track Gabe down and get him to sign her arm so she could get a tattoo of it. We did not end up doing that. But I do have to throw a special thanks to Chloe because she's the one that showed me the world of Portal so long ago. So thanks, Chloe, and I'm glad you were here for this. I love you and shit, okay?
At Skydart on the tweets.
And now the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 307 with Gabe Newell. Yay! Kermit intro!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm Gabe.
I'm Chris.
Hi, Chris.
My pleasure to meet you.
I'm Chloe.
Hi, Chloe.
Good to meet you.
I'm going to stick you in that chair right there.
That's all right.
Oh. Sorry, I'm like holding onto the companion cube.
Thank you for coming to your office.
It was easy. I got lost.
It's easy to get lost. It seems like you guys are building, adding, you know, Karen was saying you guys, it's constantly adding on and expanding. And
yeah, oddly enough, it's pretty much the same rate we've always grown at. So, since the beginning.
What floor are you at? Number 9?
Yeah.
Number 9.
When do you take over the whole block? When do you get Bellevue? Yeah.
Are we recording?
Yeah, I just started.
Great.
We're all set.
Yep.
Gabe, thank you for being here on the podcast.
thank you for having me.
I feel very official right now. Is that awkward?
Just so long as we don't have to go bowling.
You still would not be the worst bowler there, trust me.
Were you referencing the fact that you know that I bowl, or were you just throwing out bowling as a thing?
I was watching your bowling competitions with the Doctor Who cast, so
yes.
I grew up.
Are you a fan of Doctor Who?
Oh, absolutely. So I have a theory about Oswin.
Yes, 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 please.
So how do they bring Oswin back? So she keeps saying to him, remember me, remember me.
Yes.
And he's taking his watch off, so the nanophages are working on him.
Okay.
So that's what she's doing. She's actually inserting herself into the nanophages so she can be brought back later.
Oh, whoa. Shit.
Oh, my God. Did you just spoil something for us?
No, I don't know. I'm just guessing.
No, that he's a fan. He's just guessing. No,
I know.
Moffitt,
but watch. If that's what it's gonna be. And then we're like, ah, damn.
That Moffitt's brain, like, you know, the couple times I hung out with him, I just feel like, oh, you probably get the same thing, though. People just want to crack your skull open and just start poking around inside and see what's in store.
Only at very strange restaurants. Have they said anything?
He hasn't said anything yet.
So that's my theory.
That's a way better theory than just, oh, they're just going to catch her earlier in her timeline. Like, that is a way better theory.
That's brilliant.
I was like, why do they have these silly watches, right?
Yep.
And then I also assume that the pawns leave because she gets pregnant again, which is another side effect of the nanophages, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So River will have a sister. And that's my theory.
Someone has a really interesting theory online about, and I hope it's true, but I don't know, but that Rory is the master. And he's laid out all these points where he's like, remember when River was wasting all...
Did you talk about this on the podcast?
No,
before?
Not yet. When River was blowing through all the regenerations and he had a headache and it was like the thumping in his head, and then and then like the TARDIS itself wouldn't be the only thing that could create a half-time lord.
Mm-hmm.
And so like he has this, so this guy has pieced together all these theories that I should probably cut that out, because
yeah,
if that turns
that's
out
why
to,
I'm like, you shouldn't be talking about
turns,
this.
But that's just a theory that a guy had. I didn't have that theory.
Yeah, but now everybody who listens to it is going to be like, oh, damn it, Chris, if he's right.
Then I think what I should do is bleep out that entire section
just to
infuriate people.
Yep.
So then we'll just come out and be like, oh, what an amazing theory that
I think that's a fantastic theory that people will never hear about.
Very likely.
Unless it happens. Well, we'll know in like 2 weeks if that's the case or not. Were you always a fan of the show, or was it...
I started when the new series started.
Yeah.
And argue with people about which of the best of the new ones. I still liked Eccleston quite a bit.
And oh, nice.
But Matt Smith has certainly been growing on me.
Yeah.
It seems like everybody grows in the role.
So are you saying Tenet's number 3 for you?
No. It would depend upon my mood and which episode. So I like Tenet a lot. I really liked his exit. I like the fact that he played it like... He was pretty bummed out that he was regenerating.
I don't think he was playing. I think that's how he actually felt, you know. So right. Was it 10 years? Or not 10 years. How long?
No, he was on for 3 or 4 years.
10 years.
It was definitely not 10 years.
Not 10 years.
But he, I think that schedule is so demanding on them, and they literally can do pretty much nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think after a while it just is like, and I think they understand that in order to keep the show fresh, they have to recycle.
Have there been any rumors about ever bringing back either Eccleston or Tennant? Because they've done it before, right? The most they ever had at one time was four Doctor Who simultaneously.
Well, and they did stuff for like, they did like comic relief stuff where they would, you know, like mash up Doctors.
Yep.
But I don't think, I would be surprised if Eccleston did it. I've never met him and I don't know much about him, but just everything that I've been able to piece together, he kind of did it and then was sort of over it. And then like, I don't really... You know, he's the one guy that came on that I think was like, but I'm a film actor, you know? So like,
I'm bigger than this.
Yeah. I'll do your adorable children's television show for a season, but then I'm moving on.
Yep.
Have you ever gone back and watched any of the original series?
Yeah. They just never seem to grab me, right? I understand the legacy and the mythos and everything, but... I have trouble just getting over the production values.
And, I mean, it's essentially a lot of it's like almost kind of black box theater, just that 70s sort of. I think that's why it always freaked me out as a kid. Like it just looks so wrong. For some reason. But
now each episode looks like a movie. I mean, the effects on it's pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, and now Moffat's show running Sherlock and Doctor Who,
and I love Sherlock.
Such a great.
I liked the first season. I thought the parts of the second season were pretty weak. Although it wasn't the woman, It was A Scandal in Bohemia. Was that the episode with the woman who's basically the female Sherlock Holmes? That
was my favorite
episode that they've done so far.
I liked 1 and 3 of the first season, and 2 I was okay with, and then I had heard, I don't know if this is true, that 2 was actually, like, it was going so well that they're like, well, let's do an extra one, and then they ended up sandwiching it in between the first one and then the Moriarty one, the second Moriarty one.
I'm worried there's no payoff, that it's just some gag, like they had a mattress there and the vehicle you see pulling away, he was inside of it, and that, you know, that Watson didn't get close to him was an indication that he... That just seems like pretty lame. But then the original Sherlock Holmes was pretty lame when he killed him off and then brought him back. It's like, okay.
But I feel like Moffat's pretty good at paying stuff off. Like he'll want to pay it off pretty well, I think. I would imagine.
I hope so, because that's also one of my favorite shows right now.
Are you it's nice to hear that you're a fan of stuff pretty much in the same way that, I mean, I would imagine at this point people pretty much fan on you a lot. I would imagine. Have you been on the internet? Because there's a lot of it.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's something that drives a lot of people here. I mean, that's how we got into Dota, was a bunch of people here were fans of Dota. And for me, it's been a lot of fun coming into the games industry because, like, the first... I was over in London at a trade show, and this guy came up and started talking to me. And, you know, at the time, you answer a lot of questions like, you know, is that a computer? And but he was asking a lot of questions that made it clear that he knew a lot about games and game development and game design. And then I look at his name badge, and it's Warren Spector. And I was a huge fan of Ultima Underworld. Which is like one of the, you know, it was around the same time as Doom was. So having met Carmack and then getting to meet Warren Spector is like,
and then all of a sudden the tables turn, yeah. And then you leap off the stage.
Well, yeah, and I've met Miyamoto a couple of times, he's great. It's interesting to be around him when there are kids playing, because he'll just totally lose interest in any of the adults in the room. And, like, they'll be, like, over on the other side of the room playing with a Wii, and you can just see his attention drifting. You know, it's pretty admirable, because when I was over in Japan, there were American kids who were playing in the room, and he just didn't get to see American kids playing his games very often, and he really, really was struggling to divide his attention between what he was supposed to be paying attention to, according to his secretary, and what he was really interested in, which was watching these kids. So I was trying to show him Portal at the time, and so... It was like, yeah, that's kind of interesting, but...
But these kids are...
Yes, what are they doing?
Are they shooting portals into the wall and walking through them? Because that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Let me just make sure this is recording. I've done so many of these, and I still have that horrible fear that I'm going to get to the end of one. I'm going to be like, what happened to the file that should be here?
Yeah. So I think... the thing that you guys do with the Nerdist is pretty similar to what we do. It's just... letting yourself be enthusiastic fans of these kinds of entertainment properties and these communities. It just seems to be a great way to be part of the community and also be contributing to the community. You know, going through and looking, I don't think that you guys think about how you create your shows and podcasts is any different than how we approach it. It's like, we know what we love to see when other people do it, and we try to recreate it.
That is a tremendous honor to hear that from you, because I think one of the things that makes Valve legendary is not just because of the games, but also just the general philosophy that you guys have. I mean, I think people really understand that it is like by fans for fans 100% of the time. And, you know, so I guess with that in mind, how do you keep it fresh? Like, how does it not become a job for you? At some points, when you kind of get caught up in the, you know, in any kind of managerial stuff or the chore of the things that come with it, how do you keep it fun?
For all of us, I mean, first of all, the people that I work with, that everybody works with here, they're a huge amount of fun, right? I mean, we get to be fans, you know, it's like, oh, it's Red Fraggle, you know. You know, and people do incredible stuff. I mean, you get to walk down the hall and see what people have created. So that's how it feels, right? You get to, you know, see the code that somebody's written or the tools or the the movie or, you know, game design or something like that. And that's fun. And we also, well, I have to back up a little bit. I think there are these structural changes that are occurring in general across many industries. It's most obvious in the entertainment space, which is there's this blurring of lines between creators and consumers, yes. Right? There's this old notion of, you know, this auteur super far away, and even putting the experience onto film is a violation of the vision that the audience is supposed to be approaching. Stuff like that, which, you know, okay, if that's your mental model for the process you're using, that's fine. But nowadays, it's like, you know, half the time, you know, you're the audience, and there's a big difference between a good audience and a bad audience, and half the time you're the person up on stage doing stuff. And I mean that quite literally. Like, if you look at TF2 right now, the amount of content that's created in the boring way of looking at it, of, you know, how many models do they make, how many hats do they make, they make 10 times they make 10 times as much as we do. So it's, you know, this idea that somehow we're the creators and then, you know, we ship a product and people buy it, just doesn't actually fit. And the reason for that is there used to be hugely asymmetric costs to distribution. So, you know, a consumer, in order to even go over to his friend's house and get him to experience something, that was super hard. You're dragging over a DVD, you know, and that's like the way it used to be is you had to get everybody co-located for a rare instance of an experience, right? And nowadays, it's cheaper for, you know, a kid in Kansas City to sell his content to users all over the world than it was 10 years ago for the most efficient company in the world to do the yeah. same thing. So that's, you know, that's the simple way. You know, everybody has talked about it and pointed that out. But I do think it means that relationship is a lot blurrier. And that impacts, you know, your just sort of your design philosophy and how you think about stuff. It's, you're part of the audience, right? If it's not working for you, it's not going to be working for other people. And the way the company is designed is we don't have a lot of external drivers of our decisions. Like, we don't do quarterly reports, mm-hmm. right? We do annual reports because we're required to by law. But it doesn't occur to us that we're ever going to make a decision that's based on our profit or growth objectives for any given quarter. That's a deliberate choice, right? It's it allows us to do stuff like, wow, we're really enjoying this game, Dota, and let's just call this guy up and find out, you know, how he's going to be making. Oh, he's not. He's not working with anybody. Well, does anybody think it's a horrible idea for us to work with him and build it? Because he sure seems smart. That's sort of like how, if I weren't. Yeah, well, that's how I would like to believe that these things can happen, right, is that Moffat can call somebody up and say, you know what, I'm totally excited by what you did here. When, you know, it's like call J.J. Abrams and say, we should figure out how to work together. Or, you know, Brad Bird calls up some writer and says, we have to figure out some way to work together. We don't have to worry about production schedules or budgets. We just need to worry about what would be the super cool thing to go do. You know, dinosaurs in space.
Yes.
On a spaceship.
And so when you ask what it is that keeps us going, I think as long as there are exciting and interesting things, you know, that get us excited, then we're going to probably not have a whole lot of problem figuring out what to do next. It does create sort of a peculiar pathway to some of our things. So, you know, we go do Ricochet, and everybody's like, where's the sequel? And we're like, we can't figure out how to make it better. It's kind of perfect the way it is. So how could we possibly ever do Ricochet 2? You know, we tend to pick the things where it's most obvious that we can do something interesting. There's no pressure on us internally to, you know, like if you look at sports titles, there's enormous pressure to bang things out sure. on a super regular basis. And even if, you know, if that team is working on it and they say, we have no idea, you know, why there's anything interesting, you know, we haven't come up with any good ideas since, you know, what's that silly game where you roll a big weight on the ice?
Oh, you know, curling?
Curling, yeah. We haven't figured out how curling 2012 is going to be different from curling 2011.
We're going to put Tiger Woods in it.
You know, but they still, given the sort of the models they work under, they have to just keep banging those things out. Whereas you know, we're in a position where until we really understand why we're doing something that's going to be valuable and interesting, we have plenty of other things to work on. There's sort of like no called third strikes when you can really sort of, I don't want to say we're following our muse because that sounds stupid and pretentious. It's more like we get to work on the things that we think people are going to react to and say, that was the best way for you to spend your time.
Well, I think that's how you know when you're working in the right field is when you find like a, when you find the guy who's doing Dota and you don't go, hey, I want to compete with that. You go, I need to show this to the world. Like that's mm-hmm. that's how you know I think you're working in the right field, where you sort of lose, where you're not competitive in that way, where it's just like, this needs to be bigger and this needs to be shown to the world, and I want to, like, that's a kind of a whole different role.
Well, what I think is really cool, what you were mentioning before, is that you can just talk to anybody and work with them, but you also have been lending yourself to other projects, right? Mm-hmm. Like Clang, for instance. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with Clang?
Got to know the people who are involved in the project, and they said, we're trying to do this. I'm really interested in... So there are a bunch of different ways that communities can drive what is going to happen. And one of the last pieces is to figure out how the community itself can drive the financing of these projects. I actually think that that's going to happen regardless. I think there's actually securities law and banking law that has to change in the U.S. and around the world, so that it's sort of like the earlier you start supporting a project, the greater your rewards are going to be. Right now, securities law makes it very difficult for somebody to say, would you like to be an investor, right? There are a whole bunch of restrictions on that. But essentially, at the end of the day, all the money for every movie, every game, every book, all of that comes from the people who are eventually consuming it. And you've got these financial intermediaries who are not really contributing much to the eventual outcome, right? You know, a bank that makes a production loan for the next James Bond movie is probably not going to create, you know, a better James Bond movie. And so getting, you know, we spend all our time trying to, you know, we don't have financial constraints on what we do. We have time constraints. Our time constraints are 10 times as great as our financial constraints. So, but us, we spend all our time trying to figure out what our customers like and what they don't like and what we should do, right? And so our major way of doing it is releasing something, seeing what the response is. We actually force ourselves to predict in advance, and you measure that. So to us, that's, you know, we wouldn't have built TF2 the way it is, starting from where we thought it was going to end up. It took some pretty dramatic turns based on how customers were responding to stuff. And, you know, that's what drove the workshop, and that's why you're starting to see third parties using workshop. And, you know, we think we're headed to this kind of strange world where, you know, you have these kinds of sinks and creators of content that are sort of frameworks, and the content is going to become a lot more interchangeable, and the value that people have either through play or creation is going to be a lot higher. But part of the thing that keeps a lot of people from moving in that direction is the fact that where they're getting their money, whether it's a bank, whether it's a publisher, wherever, are pretty far away from what it is that people actually want. And the rate of change is so fast,
right,
that they're slowing down that transition a lot. And the more that, you know, the fans themselves can start driving these, in, you know, these production decisions, like, what is it that, you know, Neal Stephenson's super smart guy, is incredibly successful in the, you know, science fiction space, and he really wants to try to figure out, you know, he loves sword fighting a huge amount.
I've seen the videos, yeah.
He's been doing it a long time. He likes hanging out with other people and talking about it. He's pretty good at it.
Do you sword fight?
No. I have swords.
I hear you have a bunch of knives and swords and stuff.
I have a bunch of knives and swords.
That's pretty cool.
You know, I think there needs to be a way so that people can say to him, Neil, you know, that's a great idea. You should go do this. Neil, that's a really stupid idea. You should go, you know, write more books instead. And having that occur sooner in the process by people sort of betting with their own dollars, I think, is a super good idea. So philosophically, I'm a big fan of what Kickstarter and other efforts like it are trying to do. And I actually think it would be great if that it could extend not from these sort of rewards, but to actual participation in the eventual success, so that the sooner somebody starts saying there really should be another animal, was it? Manimal movie.
But there really should. I mean, we were robbed of a good manimal.
Yes. But the sooner that people can vote and say, no, we really are, I think those people become the seed around which a community develops, and it becomes pretty self-fulfilling. So I see that as being something that's going to occur over the next few years. So Neil knew I was kind of like a fan of the idea, and he said, well, why don't you help us out? Why don't you do this? And then Palmer Luckey with the Oculus Rift is also doing work. And I'm trying to sort of be a little bit of a fan boy myself on that stuff. It's like, okay, you know, the model should be, if you think something's a really good idea and you want to see that person take a swing at it, you need to contribute in some way to help make that happen. In that case, you know, I lent my name and spoke a couple words at a camera, which is fairly small thing to do, but you know, hopefully it's a model that all the fans can use as well. Like, if we really want this to happen, how can we start contributing at the beginning rather than after the thing is done? I think entertainment will get better. I think creators will do better. I think the percentage of control and the amount of money that goes to things like distribution and marketing will fall, just like it's been doing in hard goods and other places for the last 30, 40 years. And I think that's a fine thing. I think at the end of the year, or at the end of this process, it's better for everybody who's, you know, fans of these. It's going to be great for nerds.
So what do you think that the big companies are going to have to do to stay relevant?
I don't think they will. I think the rate of change is too fast for most of the companies to be able to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, I read your employee manual, like the new hire manual, and it was fascinating to me, just the sort of flat line of everything, because you are a big company, but you operate like a startup. Mm-hmm. And I think that because you own everything, it allows you to be nimble. And I always come up against this problem, like when it comes to like traditional media and television. It's like, well, the bureaucracy just fucking ruins everything because it moves at a glacial pace because so many people have to sign off. And I really think that your manual should be distributed. I mean, I don't know how most companies would operate with that sort of flat line, because people are too much, especially in entertainment, into the, well, I need my title so I can tell other people what to do. Like, there really has to be a unique philosophy for that system to work. But when it works, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world to me.
I think it draws really cool people in with that kind of philosophy, too. You end up with a really great company.
Yeah. Well, for me, it means that I get to work with Karen and Jay and Jan and Jeremy and a bunch of people who were super successful and really good at what they were doing. And it creates an environment that, you know, hopefully they find stimulating and exciting and allows them to be productive for the long run. That's why I actually think... you know, if you look at the design of a lot of modern corporations, it's derived from pretty poorly tested and thought through methods of organizing production and allocating capital. You know, it's like a lot of this stuff is copied from bad ideas about how to build armies.
Right.
If you look at the history of this, it's like, well, okay, you know, if you really want a bunch of people to go over hill and get shot, you know, okay, I understand why you approach it this way, but I think it's really, it doesn't serve people. The first thing it does is it causes everybody to think of themselves being separate from their customers rather than just being part of a community, which in this day and age is not helpful as a starting point. So I really doubt that a lot of the large corporations will be able to make transitions into the new world. I think that you'll see ad hoc groups of people forming and producing stuff and then reforming around other projects that will be way more effective and productive than, you know, traditional large media companies. And I actually think you'll start to see that extending into really surprising spaces like in hard goods. Like, there'll be a group of people who self-organize around producing a race car, and then it'll go into production. And people will go, isn't that something that traditionally required, you know, $100 billion in capital?
Right.
But the rate of change in technology will more than offset the efficiencies of scale and the sort of deeply pipelined structures that the automation, you know, the factory automation stuff. So, and another way of thinking of it is, it used to be that you had to have a big company around a big piece of capital equipment in order to use the capital equipment efficiently. Sure. And nowadays it's like, well, actually you can set up a web server and people will be designing their own widgets and making great utilization of that piece of capital equipment, and the value of the goods that are coming out of it will be way higher. So whether it's a 3D prototyper or, you know, $1 million five-axis CNC or a $10 million automated weaver, I think the interfaces so that designers don't need to be in the same organizational structure as that piece of capital equipment, it's going to be way better for those people to just say, I'm going to reserve time on those sorts of production. So I think that even way outside of the, like, if I said to you, like, really big companies are going to be terrible at putting up interesting, entertaining websites on the internet, you'd say, I totally understand that. But I actually think that even in things like, you know, the things that they should have been really good at, you know, organizing and allocating huge resources and scheduling production to use those resources efficiently, that somebody else is going to come in and put something up, and all of a sudden people are going to go, wow, that's about 40% more efficient than the track record of, you know, the GMs and Boeings of the world, and their customer, and they're building products that those guys could never build, right? You'll get your own car and things like that.
Well, because it's there's so much hierarchy and there's so much structure that the companies are like so top heavy that when the financial crisis started happening, you started seeing basically marketing departments take over entertainment companies. It was like, well, we'll get this down to a science, and we'll, you know, these demographic and flowcharts and all, you know, spreadsheets and basically the creative part was very much secondary. And now I think that's why people go, well, there's so many remakes, and there's some, they go, yeah, because marketing departments look at things, they go, people recognize this character, so we're just going to do this over again, and because we know we can sell it, you know, rather than trying to take chances on new and creative. I don't even think big entertainment really understands how to do that anymore.
Right. And there's also a lot of times, you know, the bug gets mistaken for the feature, right? Which is, you actually don't want to make the same thing for everybody. You don't want to create the same offering, whether it's goods or services, to every possible customer. You actually, you know, it's the broadcast model.
Yeah.
It's like, how could the internet work? It doesn't look like a broadcast model. People might actually get different experiences, and how could that possibly be good? And you're like, well, actually, the fact that people can, you know, it used to be, I remember, like, in the early multimedia days, the whole people from old media were actively attempting to extinguish the user's ability to navigate this through stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, well, that's not how it's supposed to work. We don't want them to actually say, I want to look at this podcast and this article and this interview, because, you know, it was like they're missing the whole point, because it didn't look like how they would program Wednesday night, you know, or you know, Seinfeld, or and the shows before and shows after. So that's I think another one of their problems is that they're still trying to say, how does this new thing map to the old model, rather than realizing that the old model was succeeded in spite of its problems, not because of, like, each person should actually end up at the end of the day with their own unique entertainment experience. That's what people would prefer. And how do you author experiences where there's that amount of unique customizability, you know, and do it efficiently?
Well, you see that, and then you create a game like Portal that everyone loves.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but I don't think you can set out. I don't think you can go, I'm going to create a game that everyone loves.
Well,
you have to.
Yeah. No, that's what's really interesting about it.
Well, but So I'm willing to say that we were good at that thing, and but we're not convinced that that's what we need to be good at in the future. Yeah. So if you look at the amount of personal customization that can go into TF2, that's the beginning of being able to offer people, you know, personalized entertainment experiences. You know, I'm just pretty sure we're going to keep going more and more in that direction, so that each person gets an optimal experience for them, not the same experience that everybody gets.
Well, then I have a question about that. Is there any concern about? Because sometimes I wonder, and I say this as being a part of the consumer group. Are we too spoiled as consumers because we get stuff whenever we want, mostly for free, exactly the way we want it? Is that spoiling us? Because like particularly in comedy in the old days, there were super comedians. There was Steve Martin, there was Richard Pryor, there was Seinfeld, there, you know, and everyone kind of came together to celebrate these things. And then as we got more and more splintered and more niche, now people are less likely to come together over things. Is that good or bad?
I didn't get to watch Doctor Who when I was a kid, so yeah, I'd say it's bad. I didn't, you know, there was, you know, you could watch all the television you wanted as long as it was on one of three channels. I think I'm not super worried about the fragmentation, because I actually think I see the opposite, which is people are finding more and more people to be engaged with. So, you know, when I watch kids play, I was listening to these kids playing one of our games, and they started shouting at their television in Russian. And I'm like, what the fuck? Why? You know, and they're like, well, we're playing with people in Russia, and they don't understand English, and so we, you know, they were learning a new language because
they could heckle the Russian kids.
They were actually trying to get them to go do something.
Oh, okay, okay. That's
funny. And, you know, it's an interesting environment because you have shared goals and, you know, you tend to repeat the same things over and over. So it's actually an interesting environment in which, for really domain-specific ways, you're going to pick up another language.
Sure.
It's like, put teleporter here. And they were like, well, the Russian for that is, you know, because somebody had yelled it at them. And that was sort of my point. It's like, I don't think these kids ever would have, you know, pre this fragmentation, they never would have encountered people like themselves who happened to be, I don't know, living in Siberia. I don't know where they were, Siberia. I'll just say Siberia because it's fun. My Little Pony. You know, I'm a fan of the My Little Pony shows. I never would have been able to connect with other grown-ups who are interested in My Little Pony before everything started to fragment. So I really think people are finding... It was an interesting lesson when I started working with DirecTV back in my previous job at Microsoft, where it's like, well, how do you think about programming? And they say, the fact that we can reach, you know, 250 million people means that markets that were previously never going to be served, like people who speak some Chinese language, now becomes an incredibly profitable business for us. So people who are never, ever, ever going to get television programming with the old broadcast model suddenly could get television, because when you aggregated them together, they were a huge community. So a bunch of people who weren't getting served were. And that's always sort of made me a little bit thoughtful, because it was like, oh, that's right. And rather than flattening everybody and saying you're all exactly the same, we're now saying it's much easier to find people. You can broadcast to other people all over the world for, you know, basically for free. And that means you're going to find a bunch of people who like doing, you know, Sherlock cosplay in a steampunk thing, you know.
Wait, hang on, though. Can we go back just for a second? So you're a brony?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know what I watch My Little Pony. I'm a fan of the show. So when people say, are you a brony? Usually they have some weird, creepy aspect.
They imagine you're dressing up and running around.
What is it about My Little Pony that you love so much? I've never seen the show.
You should watch the show. It's a really well-made show. The previous, I've gone and watched some of the old My Little Pony's terrible television. But Lauren Faust and the people that she pulled together, it's just great television. The first six or seven episodes of the first season are a little bit weak because they kind of had the clamps on the creators because, you know, this is a kid's show. You can't call somebody a nerd, right? And that's a real issue that the creative team had with the people at Hasbro. And there was an educational consultant, which essentially meant idea Nazi, who would forbid them from doing a bunch of stuff. And then after the first several episodes, they started to, you know, let the reins get a little looser, and it turns out to be a great show. It's just a good show to watch.
I enjoyed your use of the word reins in that sentence.
Okay. That is kind of funny, though, particularly when you're like with children's television, where like, you can't say this, you can't say this, you can't. And then, but what happens is, a lot of times these writers are, a lot of them have comedy backgrounds, so they start figuring out little more subversive ways to get their messages across that just skate right past the people that are censoring them.
Yeah. So I think it's just good television.
Check it out. I promise you I will check that out.
I think it's time for a ponython.
Well, I also have to say I hated The Sopranos, so I'm just calibrating. I didn't like any of the characters in The Sopranos. I didn't think that the storylines were going anywhere.
What about My Little Tony? Where you have a group of tiny, adorable Sopranos
beating the shit out of each other.
That's right. And then prancing around on.
I'm gonna whack you with my hoof.
Oh, I would watch that. Listen, in today's mashup culture,
yep,
there is no way that My Little Sopranos would not be. That's probably already a fucking T-shirt.
I was gonna
somewhere.
Say T-Fury probably already
yeah,
made that shirt.
Yeah, you're gonna T-Fury or Threadless.
Ripped apparel.
Someone's done that.
Yeah,
at
My
some
Little
point.
Sopranos. If not, somebody get on that.
Well, I always wanted to do L Word Babies, but no one would let me do it. Yeah, just tiny, adorable
like
lesbian
babies
with giant heads living out loud.
Oh, there is a movie called Gaby, which is coming out, which is a gay man is helping father a baby.
So it's
and
not a gay baby.
No, but they call it a gaby, which was the first time I'd ever heard that phrase, except when I was a kid and I was being tortured. But Gaby.
Oh, of course.
So that's why I alerted when I saw this. But it's essentially the L word babies.
How do you feel about being called Gaben, out of curiosity?
Well, the weird thing is that that's always the name I've had for, you know, I was Gaben at Microsoft.com, and, you know, it was just the naming convention when they use when you're giving you an email address.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, you start to, this is early on when, like, my brother was one of the first people to use email. He's like he was at Stanford near Park. And so all these sort of early things where, oh, we have two people named Bob. Big surprise. So then you'd start to refer to people by their email address because that was a unique handle. So Bob Matthews was Bob M. And the longer your name ended up being, that was an indication almost of seniority, right? So if you had your name and then you had like seven letters of your last name, it just meant, you know, that all of the other letters had been already consumed by somebody else. So you were just used to, so when people would refer to me, they'd say Gabe N, right? Because I was Gabe N at Microsoft.com. Right. And then when Mike Harrington and I started Valve, we just used the same naming convention. So.
So you were referred to as Gabe N, like Gabe N.
Yeah.
Before all the commentary thing
right.
happened.
I'm not totally clear where people are going with the whole how do you stop a gay Ben? I don't know if there's some like...
How do you feel about kind of being like an internet meme? I don't feel like it's a mean thing because people adore you, and I think that's sort of where it comes from.
Well, I like it when people take something that I do or we do as a company and run with it. And if one of those things they want to run with is my email address, that's a good sign, right?
Oh, boy. So I'm still laughing about the how you're stopping.
Yeah, Reddit's pretty fond of you.
Yeah, Reddit loves you.
Yeah, well, we all love Reddit here, so. Although they were trying to get me to declare my love for either 4chan or Reddit, and I was like, no way am I getting into that in the middle of that.
Really?
That would just be, you know, nuclear wasteland if I'll just let them fight it out.
Well, that's you should never answer that question.
Whoever can take down the Lithuanian central bank first, they get my...
No, don't say that, because they'll do it.
Yes.
Wait, have you spent some time on 4chan?
Yeah.
4chan and Reddit?
Yeah, everybody... You have to understand, everybody here is a massive consumer of internet stuff.
So you would consider yourself an internet denizen?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you balance between... Because the problem that I've been finding lately is in the last couple of years, just with sort of the growth of our little company, is that I've been realizing recently, like, I've not really devoted as much time to consumer as I should, as much as like, oh, I've got to make stuff. And mm-hmm. there are things that I'm finding like, oh, I missed the last four episodes of that thing, or I didn't get to play that game. So I was reading your manual. You said, listen, the manual says, if you're working overtime, then you're not balancing your time correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you manage that? How do you manage the balance between consumer and creator?
I don't spend a lot of time anguishing over it. I'm sort of willing to trust my impulses. You know, it's been doing this a while, and you start to recognize your own tendencies and how you manage around them. So I'm pretty good about balancing that sort of automatically at this point. You know, it's something that I'm sure you guys have run into as well. Like, one of the, you know, we tend to think of people who are working as being on this continuum of experience. Like, when people first start out, they're like, but why shouldn't I, you know, do drug deals on corporate email? And you're like, because not a good idea. And, you know, there are just a bunch of things that you learn. You learn how to be an individual contributor. You learn how to make the people around you more valuable. One of the things you end up having to learn, and it's one of the issues we tend to work with people on, is not being burned out. Mm-hmm. Like, we say to people, no, you have to do this for the long haul. And everybody has known people who've gotten burned out, and they're, you know, powerlessness is actually, you know, a huge part of it. Feeling that you are bearing the costs of somebody else's bad decisions is one of the drivers of burnout. And we try to work with people and say, look, you know, nobody's going to manage this better than you. If you're feeling burned out, you need to think about what it is that's causing that to occur. Is it an internal issue, an external issue? You need to, you know, that's just one of the things. In the same way you've learned all of these other skills, you need to learn how to manage your own frustration level. And you know, I've known people, I'm sure you guys have, I've known people who basically blow up for like a decade. They're just like, they work insanely hard, and then they just grind to a halt, and then they just are stuck. And then, you know, they eventually restart. But, you know, the longest I've seen is somebody who just couldn't subject themselves to the sort of the intensity of the pressure. It's like their brain was saying, no, we can't trust ourselves yet to go back into this. And the same thing with, you know, how do you balance between, you know, being a consumer and a producer? It's like, you know, it's just you eventually get to something that you recognize as being a good balance. And you also can see the results, right? I mean, Eric and Zabi and Adrian, when they contacted Ice Frog, it was like, are we being self-indulgent here or not? And, you know, they were right. They thought about it. And certainly there are times when we have done projects or, you know, invested our individual time where we've had to look back and say, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. But that's an example where the people were like, is this self-indulgent? No, this is actually probably a really good idea. And turned out, you know, they came and poked at me and said, what do you think? And I said, no, I think it's a fine thing to go do. That was before I met Ice Frog, and afterwards I was like, nah, you guys are right. There's something here that is totally worth pursuing. So it's just, you know, one of those things. You just learn it over time, and experience helps a lot. Having people around you who can give you good perspective on it is super useful.
It's an incredible amount of faith, though, to... In the process, I mean, because there seems to be a thing that happens with your company, because it seems like, okay, the philosophy of where there's a flat line and there's not really an org chart in the traditional sense, that when you're a small company, of course, everyone, like, we're all on the same team and everyone can float around and do whatever they want. And then, well, then we scale and then it gets bigger. And then, you know, and then I think maybe you're kind of surprised that it ends up working. But it seems like that there is this kind of, if you work with the right people, this kind of like they form sentient masses together.
Right. So, you know, there are a bunch of consequences around that that you need to do. I mean, the most obvious being who you add to the collective is insanely important. One person can have a lot of negative externalities, to use economics terminology, and you have to deal with it. But I actually think that more and more you're going to find that highly structured, non-self-organizing groups can't deal with the rate of change, right? That organizations are enemies of what you're going to do next year. They're a chronicle of what you were successful at previously. And if things change very slowly, that may not hurt you, but the rate of change of things is so high. For example, if you had a company and you created, you know, here's the vice president in charge of social, and, you know, he was hiring a director of social, and then all of a sudden you had to hire your vice president of mobile, and then all of a sudden it turns out that their, you know, Facebook's IPO didn't go as well as everybody thought, and Zynga's, you know, stock market, and this whole investment, well, you still have this organization, right? You still have everybody who's chasing the last battles, and they look at their, you know, business cards. So I actually think that it's really a function of the rate of change, and that everything that we see is that the rate of change is increasing, not decreasing. It's always nice to say, well, you know, over the last 10 years, we've seen all of the change that we're going to have to, and if we can just get on top of this, then we'll be successful. But in the same way, I think Microsoft was really startled by Google, and Google was startled by the emergence of Facebook. It's like, come on, guys. I mean, you were sitting there watching IBM completely fail to adapt quickly enough to the rate of change in the technology industry. You shouldn't be surprised that if you do a bunch of things that make you less responsive to customers or technologies or how businesses are evolving, you shouldn't be surprised that you get left further and further behind.
There definitely is a sense of
and simply picking the next target to aim at,
right,
doesn't solve the problem, because you'll just fall further and further behind that.
So is it even possible for, I mean, you know, Microsoft is still making money, but is it even possible for a company like Microsoft, or is it just such a monolith that it's I mean, how do they, in a situation like that, do you just topple the whole structure and start over? Like, what do you do when it's that?
You know, when you talk about them as a corporation, most of the things that people are referring to as a corporation are not particularly valuable going forward, right? It's like the things, like, well, we have a senior vice president of worldwide OEM sales channels. It's like, okay, that's great. And you've got this whole org chart, and you've got all these pricing structures, and you've got all these, you know, marketing materials. And how exactly is that going to help you in microtransaction-based free-to-play application software, right? It's like the thing that we call the corporation isn't, it's actually a penalty for all of the people who are involved and for all of the capital that's involved and so on. It's not additive, and I think that that's going to become increasingly obvious in the future, right? I mean, corporations are not really, they're also not that old, and a lot of the practices that are associated with them are not that old, so it's not like, you know, these things have withstood, you know, 1,000 years of history, and I think that the things that we call corporations are not, you know, I think the internet is, and then whatever comes after the next thing after the internet are inherently better. I think that the internet will do a better job of organizing most people's output and enabling their consumption than typical distribution channels and corporations.
I think it might be quantum telepathic information rings, where we can just sit in a room and then all of a sudden just share, like,
Well, yeah, I mean, right now we have what we think is this super awesome forward-looking project. So you know, it's something Carmack's talked about and Abrash has talked about. We're looking at, you know, have we reached the point where augmented reality technology is such that it goes out of, you know, investment banking, destroying, you know, capital black holes and into something that actually might, you know, be a pretty cool product. So we're digging into that, and already you can see the next thing after that. You go and look at this woman, she runs a department at Cornell, and they're working on sort of the retina brain system, and she's actually made a huge amount of progress at looking at the coding. So in other words, just skip the whole front, you know, from the retina forward, and just drive stuff directly into your brain. And everybody goes, it's science fiction. Well, holy shit, we haven't even made any progress of significance on AR and VR, and already you're looking at this thing that looks an awful lot like, you know, well, we could just, you know, drive stuff directly into your brain. And that's not 20 years from now. She's publishing these papers right now. And there's a lot of research going on where you're like, wow, why should we waste a bunch of, you know, it's like, you know, wow, we could work on touch interfaces, or we could just beam it directly into your, you know, frontal lobe.
So
it's lower power.
So how are you feeling about like Microsoft's new technology? Was it the smart glass? Is that what it?
Okay, well, smart glass, and then Google's whole
smart or smart touch. Oh my God, I'm totally spacing on the name of it. The new glass controllers.
Uh huh.
Microsoft came out with these new controllers.
Surface.
Are they, I don't think
the new controllers, or are you talking about the new Windows RT tablets?
The tablets.
So those the Surface ones, you know, the details that are leaking out make it sound like it's not going to be super competitive even with the iPad. The main point that I was making, though, was that it seems like the rate of change is increasing. So the things which have been challenging to existing approaches, like corporations, that those challenges are not decreasing. It's not like they can just, well, if we just figure out this social networking thing, then we can be done. It's like the ways of getting people to collaborate effectively that are most responsive, most flexible in the face of change, and mitigate the risk of the rate of change are going to be the things that are more successful, right? So that was the point I was making. I wasn't like referring specifically to, you know, oh, we should never work on AR at all. We should just go directly to, you know, direct neural stimulation. It was more the point that even when we think that we're working on something super advanced, we're already looking at the thing that could be disruptive. You know, she could like make a bunch of progress in 6 months, and then all of a sudden everybody looks at these products that haven't even shipped, and you say, so we have to figure out not only how to ship products, but also how to not ship products.
Yeah,
right. It's like we should just skip this whole generation.
It's the rate of obsolescence is fucking crazy. Well,
but the thing that's weird to me is a lot of the companies nowadays are actually sort of playing copycat with each other. You know, we've got the motion control, and then we've got the smart glass and the tablets, and they're all just sort of copying each other.
Yeah, I don't think that my sense as a consumer is that, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to just simply be trailing edge, low cost producer of something, because the forward edge is going to be so changing so quickly. It's like everybody who's trying to copy what Apple's been doing in the tablet space is just getting crushed.
Yeah.
Right. There's a reason that they're the most valuable company in the world is that they're on the front edge, and then everybody else who's like saying, but we did exactly what you did 2 years ago, and everybody says, yeah, and then that's why we're not buying your thing. And it used to be that you could, you know, do what somebody was doing 5 years ago, you know, in terms of the fundamentals of what you're implementing, and you were, you know, you just had to take, you know, a 10% hit on your profit margins, and there you were. And you know, it's like you're either there or you're getting left further and further behind.
Do you think that the companies should adopt? I love the T approach to your employees, where it's like it's this T shape where they should be really good at a bunch of different things, at a bunch of different disciplines, but amazing at one at the same time. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's a good model for companies, or is that just better for individuals?
I think the big problem is, you know, I think there's going to be this huge inverse. I think all the smartest people and the hardest working people and the people who are most connected to their customers are going to increasingly not understand why their current employer is helping them do what they do better. And so the people who are going to be left behind inside the corporations are, you know, it's going to slowly be, they're going to sort of, you know, vampire off of what the corporations have traditionally done. And but there's going to be this horrible, ugly, you know, toxic wasteland inside of the corporation, and it'll fall over. Right? I mean, if you look at General Motors, I think they've destroyed $350 billion of value since 1971. So in 1971, if you'd simply stopped GM in its tracks and just said, don't ever sell another car, send everybody home, you'd be $350 billion ahead of where you are now, letting them be in the car business over that period, right? Seems like the world is trying to tell them to stop, right? And I think you're going to see that sort of over and over again. I mean, it was pretty obvious even back then that GM was never going to get its, you know, and that anybody who didn't, everybody who saw it and saw that they weren't changing course, they left. They went and did something else. And any sane person who was in school, who was talented and cared about doing something cool, they said, no, I'm not moving to Detroit. And, you know, so they torched a giant pile of money in the process. And I just think that's an instance of what we'll see over and over again.
I don't mean to make you talk all about corporate stuff, but I am truly fascinated by just seeing...
Well, just, I mean, you know, if some 14-year-old came to you and said, give me advice of what I should do, right? You're not going to tell them that they should... you're going to be pointing to a whole bunch of people who are visible through the internet as examples of interesting choices about their lives. But you're not going to be saying, oh, there's this corporate path and there's job security.
No. I would tell them, I would say...
And middle management is something that you should really think about.
Oh, my God. I've been so... I'm sorry. I really want to talk about games, too, but I just... This middle management thing is such a fucking stumbling block. And I have only just, in the last, like, 6 months to year, really seen... How many good things get crushed by middle management people who are afraid of getting fired? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you can actually just go around middle management to the people who make decisions and go, hey, here's this thing. They'll go, oh, yeah, that's great. Let's just do that. Like, so middle management is like a goddamn minefield.
So when somebody's here, right, nobody here says my job is to act as a gatekeeper on somebody else's work, right? So almost everybody here builds something that customers directly experience, right? Nobody says my job is to go to the people who are actually creating something that's valuable and give them permission to do it or not give them permission to do it. And that's where this sort of comes from, right? You need to understand, a lot of times having this perspective, like a lot of the people here have run their own companies. And it's that perspective of understanding the side effects of some of their choices that makes them really valuable, right? Mm-hmm. They don't say, oh, we're going to change this and not realize that there are implications. But everybody here is insanely good at doing something that a customer is going to look at and go, holy cow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's programming or animation or music or whatever. And that knowing that the thing that you're doing is actually creating value is super useful. And you look at, I'm going to pick on GM because it's fun. I would say 98% of the people who work there are not involved in any way in anything that any customer actually ever directly experiences. And you're like, how could that possibly be? And you're, well, it works when you, you can talk about, anyhow, it's not going to work in the future. And I think it's interesting because, you know, when I think about our future games, I think about the people who are listening to this, you know, on their PCs or wherever. And I think those are my future partners, right? That there's this kind of expanding Schrodinger wave function, you know. And I'm really talking to the people who are going to be thinking of how to make Dota 3 better, right, or TF3 better. So I'm actually talking about games. When I think about the structure, I think about who am I going to be working with in the future to build the awesome thing that I'm going to enjoy being part of creating and consuming, and that they are as well.
I just want to point out for a second that Gabe actually does know how to count to three.
They give you a lot of shit for that. I because people.
One, two,
squirrel. Oh, damn it!
It's no, almost no, no. there. There's one more.
Gave me out from one to squirrel.
Okay, from squirrel, where do you go?
I asked Will Wheaton, who is one of my best friends. I told him yesterday that I was like, Will, it's too bad you're not in Seattle because we're going to talk to Gabe Newell tomorrow. And he was like, no fucking way. Like, he flipped his lid. And so I said, listen, if you could ask Gabe anything, what questions would you have? And so he said, here's my question for Gaben. Steam has fundamentally changed the games industry by allowing games from indie studios to be distributed right next to the biggest AAA titles. Did you intend for this to happen when you developed the platform, and how do you feel about it?
So we suspected it would be a consequence of what we were doing, but we were really letting customers decide. You know, if you ask me what I thought was happening, I thought that it would broaden the choices that customers would have and increase the reach that creators would have. But we really also didn't want to steer it, right? We thought this would be kind of awesome if it happened, but we're, you know, we try to keep from putting our thumb on the scale because, you know, there's a risk of biasing the answer if we say, oh, well, this is really gonna, you know, if customers really want to play X or Y or Z, we don't want to be the people who are interfering it because that marginalizes the value of Steam in the first place, mm-hmm. which really is about increasing the signal-to-noise ratio between content creators and consumers. And if indie guys need to know that they should be scaling up their efforts, so you could look at an indie guy and he could be saying the question, should I spend, you know, $500,000 on a title or $5 million on a title? And, you know, we have our opinions about what we think is right for our games, but it's a really important question is how much risk should be taken on each of these projects. And Steam helps everybody make better choices about that. So we feel at this point that, you know, the best, you know, we need to ship all the time because we don't think we're smart enough to make decisions that are too far into the future because we keep finding out, we keep tripping over the choices that our customers are making. In that same way, we think we shouldn't be telling the customers or, you know, their communications with developers that indie games should be more successful, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We really thought it would. Everything about it seemed to indicate it if our understanding was correct. But we also didn't want to be affecting the outcome because then we're decreasing the amount of information or we're biasing the amount of information that's flowing through the system. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And it's also interesting that in a way it's kind of a fearless approach to take that you're allowing a platform for people to develop stuff that could potentially be better than the stuff that you're developing.
And you promote it with the Humble Indie Bundles, which is uh-huh. awesome.
Will's second. Marimba Lessons?
Yes.
And then, of course, Will says, I didn't want to ask you this, but Will wrote this, and I promised I would. Okay. As a personal favor to me, would you please make Half-Life 3? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring it up. I apologize. I'm sure you get that shit all the time. That's probably your did-you-fuck-Jenny-McCarthy question that I always get from people.
But we had to ask the question. Otherwise, okay. I mean, we just had to.
Did you fuck Jenny McCarthy?
Oh, damn it! It's only fair that you ask me that question back.
Did you fuck Jenny McCarthy?
Chloe, hey, it's fine. Whatever. No on the Jenny McCarthy question. And now your turn.
Okay.
No, he's not going to answer. You shouldn't answer.
No, I didn't fuck Jenny McCarthy.
Karen, I just got a mail from Christina to call.
Dun, dun, dun.
Karen was actually the person that engineered all this. And Karen Prell, I just want to thank you so much.
Thank you, Karen.
Because Karen, we worked with Karen. I may have to cut this out. But Karen is Red Fraggle. And we shot this video together, and she said,
"Very
oh,
cool." The Ben Folds.
The Ben Folds video, yeah. And she said, "Oh, I work at Valve," and I was like, "And Chloe."
I'm a little bit of a fan.
Chloe is a
She's
huge.
A little bit.
I'm
a huge Ben Folds fan, so we've completed.
It all worked together. We completed some type of matrix. So for me, I was a huge gamer from the time that you could play video games, and in the early 2000s, I gave up video games pretty much the same way I had to quit drinking because I was like, it is just consuming too much of my life. And then a couple of years ago, Portal was the game that pulled me back in.
And
now you're an alcoholic.
And I thought it was okay to drink again and to do a lot of drugs. But I think the thing for me that Portal touched was, and I hope you take this as a compliment, it had the same vibe to me as sitting on an Apple IIe computer playing Zork. Uh-huh. It's just that same kind of like the game's fucking with you a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And it made me so, I don't know, so Portal brought me back in. And as I've said before, Portal 2, I think, is one of the best, not just written games, but one of the best written things in all media that I've ever experienced.
Yeah, it was, I totally know what you're talking about. When we started Valve, we were kind of bummed. Mike and I were both gamers, and we played a lot of Doom. And when I played Doom, it scared the hell out of me. Like, I hadn't been scared as an adult for real in a...
You just missed something great in Scott's office.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to finish this anecdote. When I played Doom, I didn't have the sense that the people who played Doom a lot had, which was of complete mastery. Like, when they played, they'd walk into a room, there'd be 1,000... you know, monsters, they'd slaughter them all, and their only challenge was to play multiplayer. My experience was, holy cow, the blinking light is bad. I don't want to go to the blinking light. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I realized I had created this entire fiction in my head, and I was scared. I was genuinely scared. Like, you know, hair on the back of my neck was standing up, and I hadn't, you know, had that emotional look. Wasn't exactly looking for it. You go to horror movies and you spend most of your time laughing. And here I was scared. There were choices that I knew I ought to make that I was unwilling to make because of those consequences. Like, holy cow, games are awesome. Games are going to win, right? Because I just don't get this any other way, the sense of choice and engagement and so on. And when we looked at the response to Doom, which was to completely ignore that experiential aspect of it, you know, of this sense of a world and a story and being involved with these, being engaged with these characters in a some sort of meaningful way, which, you know, is a weird thing to say. Instead, everybody was creating a shooting gallery, and that just seemed to miss that whole thing. And so, both, you know, with the Half-Life series and then on into Portal, that's, you know, that's totally what we've been responding to. It was like, there's this opportunity in games to do that kind of thing. And it's exciting when we can pull it off. It's exciting when other people in the field, you know, do something interesting to make that happen. You know, and now I'm all excited and I want to go play some games.
Wait, I have two questions really quick before you go. Have you played back? I can't talk.
Black Mesa?
Black Mesa, yes.
No, I haven't played it yet. I know I have to, but I haven't played it yet.
I know I haven't either. I will.
Left 4 Dead is like one of the biggest significant things in Chloe's life.
Right? My entire bedroom is zombie. It's all right. Zombies. I have Left 4 Dead posters all over
my
walls.
I hope you don't mind that we fan all over you
and then,
a little bit.
Last question. Can you tell us about the ARG stuff? Or not the ARG. The augmented reality. Can you tell us about the augmented reality stuff?
So VR is just the simple way of thinking of it is being in the environment. AR is mixing together the real environments and the virtual environments. There are a bunch of gnarly technical problems around how people do visual processing and things like Scikids, you know, where your eye basically turns off for 20 milliseconds as the eyeball moves, and judder, and there are a bunch of things about it that, you know, when people sort of went on the whole horrible VR ride, VR helmets, wearable computer thing, you know, and, you know, all of those companies blew up, and all of those experiences were just really horrible. Like, you know, for me, VR game is right up there with interactive movie as signs of things to be avoided at all costs. But we've actually, oddly enough, as every one of the companies has finally ran out of its last little bits of venture capital, a bunch of the hard problems have actually been solved. And we're kind of right on the border of being able to do interesting augmented reality, which, you know, be in an environment, have the software recognize what the environment is in an interesting way. In other words, look at this and say, this is a table, this is a chair, you're people, I know who you are. And to be able to indistinguishably map on top of that a virtual environment, right? So you could, you know, if you had a good enough renderer to basically photorealistically map in things that make the virtual things in the environment indistinguishable from the actual things in the environment. So once you have that capability, the question becomes, what are the interesting things to do with it, right? So if I put hats on you, that's probably stupid.
You can put a hat on me any day.
Yes. But hopefully we're going to find interesting things to do with those capabilities. Right now we're mainly focusing on the plumbing part, which is kind of boring. You know, we can say we're going to enable stuff, but we can't show you the stuff that we have enabled. It's easy enough to take one of our existing games and play them in those kinds of environments, but that sort of misses the whole point of having these new capabilities. So the question really becomes, why? What is the valuable, awesome thing you can do when you can mix a game environment with the real environment, given the fact that the real environment is pretty much going to ignore what's happening in the virtual environment, right? So you have this weird situation where you have a monster in the room, and the deal is, as long as the monster doesn't move any of the furniture, it's going to be fine. Now, the nice thing is you can share that, right? So if we're all sitting here in a staff meeting and some of us have AR, then we can be playing the monster game while the boring guy is giving his slideshow. But it's trying to find the thing where you say, okay, now I get why why this is interesting. If you describe to me motion input before and after Wii Sports, like before Wii Sports, I'd go, that is a total waste of time. I'm sitting here, I'm trying to think of ways that's interesting. I use Wii Sports for 10 minutes. I go, oh, I totally get it. There are a whole class of things you can't do unless you have this capability. So we're at that stage where we're trying to figure out, given these capabilities, you know, are enabled by writing a bunch of software and having the right hardware, what are the interesting things we can do? Could turn out to be a total waste of time. It's traditionally been a total waste of time. But we're going to take another swing at that. But
Do you want to leak anything before we go?
I don't have anything to leak. If I were had something leakable,
come
I would
on,
be,
take a leak. Come on.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for chatting with us.
It was fun,
and I really hope. I mean, listen, we
and if I'm right about Doctor Who, then we have to go bowling.
Oh shit, we'll totally go bowling.
Oh my god,
we come back
up here.
We'd
love to. Yeah.
A lot. As a matter of fact, I would listen. I'm sure a lot of people tell you this, or the people are always tugging at your pants about this. But if you ever want to collaborate on anything with us, just anything fun, I think a Nerdist Valve thing would be super, super fun.
Great, I'll think about that. I was, you know, going through the Nerdist earlier, and so I actually think that's a totally worthwhile thing to do, because that's really, you know, the model for going forward. It's the nature of what we think the entertainment beast is, and a lot of other things, is how can you create structures. So it's not just collaborating with the Nerdist, it's collaborating with all of the people who go there too, and what would be a fun thing to do. So I'll think about it.
Well, thanks, man.
Awesome.
Sure.
It is.
It's a magic number.
I haven't heard of it before. So.
It's a magic number.
It's a mystic trinity.
That's a magic number.
If I were Catholic, it's just Catholic.
Any company could do what it needs to give a fucking new. That's a magic number. That's a magic number. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.